Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org. Additional support comes from the Jackson Laboratory, researching the root causes of cancer and other genetic diseases, designated a cancer center by the National Cancer Institute, JAX.org.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Gridiron Goliaths have girded, and now they're grinding, grabbing, and going for the goal line ahead on Only a Game, a college football season preview. Also, meet a member of a select group of runners who've hit the pavement every day for at least 40 years, and a conversation with former Giants linebacker Hall of Famer Harry Carson. Also ahead, the world's best cliff divers scale a prominent Boston art institution and plunge into the ocean 88 feet below.
The big key is being able to land perfectly straight up and down, because no matter how good in shape you are, if you land flat, it's really going to hurt, put you in the hospital.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. On Thursday night, the 2011 college football season commenced with 14 Division I games, including Wisconsin's 51-17 drubbing of UNLV and Mississippi State's 59-14 romp over Memphis. There must be some better competition ahead, don't you think? For the answer, I turn to Dan Wetzel of Yahoo Sports. Dan, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you very much. I hope you didn't watch any of those drubbings.
I can say with absolute certainty I did not. Today's marquee matchup would seem to be number 3 Oregon against number 4 LSU. Have I got that right?
That would be it.
Tell me a little bit about those two teams.
Both, obviously, highly ranked, top 5. Very rare that you have a top 5 matchup to start a season. They're playing on a neutral site in Texas, the Jerry Jones Stadium and at Cowboy Stadium. And both obviously have national championship aspirations. So a loss in this game, while not crippling, would certainly not help the cause, particularly for Oregon. LSU plays in the Southeastern Conference. They could presumably come back. Really, the story of this game, though, is sort of the theme of all of college football lately. There's numerous suspensions on both sides. We've had, you know, everything from newfangled controversies, including scouting service scandals, with both teams to old-fashioned bar fight suspensions that you get. It's been going on for 100 years. So both teams are a little bit limited on who they're going to trot out on the field, but they're still two of the best teams in the country.
The aforementioned game has been referred to by some as the Will Liles Bowl. Why is that?
Well, Will Liles is a talent scout out of Houston, Texas. He had a service where schools could hire him, and both Oregon and LSU did, to provide scouting information on high school and junior college players. Will also was a guy who had very close relationships with a number of top players, some of whom ended up at Oregon and LSU. The NCAA is looking into how he conducted his scouting service, whether the schools were really paying Will Liles for the access and influence he had with recruits, more than just the basic information, can this guy play well, heights and weights and things like that.
What are some of the other games that we should be paying attention to today?
Well, there's a number of games that I think will just be interesting. They may not be competitive, but you have a new coach at Ohio State for the first time in a decade, Luke Fickell, who's replacing Jim Tressel, who lost his job over the summer. It's a new coach at Michigan, Brady Hoke. The other real marquee game is Boise State playing the University of Georgia, both teams in the top 20. They're playing in Atlanta. But I think when you're starting anew with college football, there's also just interest in the new quarterbacks, new coaches, new systems, and kind of a return to normalcy.
Oklahoma and Alabama are ranked 1 and 2, respectively. Have the experts got that about right?
I think it's hard not to put an SEC team in the number one spot, since that league has won the last 5 national championships. So I would say by default, I would have put Alabama number one, or whoever you think is going to win the Southeastern Conference. Both teams return a tremendous defenses. One of the things that's kind of become a dominating threat in college football is how good your defensive line is. These guys that can control the offensive line, rush inexperienced college passers, and control the line of scrimmage defensively against the rushing attack, which is also more important than the NFL, where the skill level is higher. Both these teams have ferocious defensive lines, and so they obviously have great coaches in Bob Stoops and Nick Saban, guys that know how to win a lot of games. So it would surprise nobody in college football if the final game matchup is Alabama and Oklahoma.
You and your Yahoo Sports colleagues broke the story of a gift scandal currently overshadowing the University of Miami, and overshadowing it may be putting it much too lightly. This week, the NCAA suspended 8 current Hurricanes players who will also have to pay some restitution. This matter's not going to go away quickly, is it?
No, because really the current players were only limitedly involved with the booster, Nevin Shapiro, who's been in prison for the last 19 months, so obviously would have no access to the players. And the gifts he had given to these current guys are fairly low. I mean, it's a number of suspensions, but most of them for one game or, there's a 4 and a 6. I thought maybe even the suspensions were a little high. But the real issue isn't so much how much he gave to individual players, because often it was free parties, free access to his VIP space at a South Beach nightclub or trips out on his yacht. It's really the totality of it, because there are so many players that he identified. It's not really about what the players took. It's why did the university not police their boosters better and keep an eye on this guy? He was a red flag kind of guy. He is a Ponzi schemer. I should have mentioned why he's in prison. He ran a $930 million Ponzi scheme. It's really a scandal where the focus shouldn't be on what the players took, but what the university took, because they wanted his money just as much as any player did.
Miami, of course, isn't the only program facing sanctions. On Thursday, Ohio State announced the suspension of 3 players for accepting money. You mentioned earlier the problems at LSU and Oregon and the investigations there. How long is the list of teams that have apparently run afoul of the NCAA?
It's lengthy right now. It's probably at least a dozen deep. And yeah, as much as it's a black eye for college sports, I actually think there's something healthy to it, because it's created such tension and such friction that NCAA leaders are beginning to take maybe a little bit more of a critical eye at their own rules and saying, maybe we do need to adapt some of these rules. Maybe we need to take care of the players better. Maybe we need to rethink all of the concepts of amateurism. So I think something good can come out of this, because really what they've tried to do is jam the square peg of amateurism into the round hole of capitalism, and that just doesn't work. We've had these payoff stories forever, and the flurry of them kind of shows that nobody has control over college athletics, and maybe it's the system that needs to change. I doubt they will change it as dramatically as I would recommend, but any kind of progress I think would be good for college athletics.
Dan Wetzel covers college football and other games for YahooSports.com. Dan, thanks very much for talking with me.
Thanks, Bill. Always fun.
The University of Nebraska-Omaha has joined the Division I club this fall, but that decision comes with a hefty price tag and the loss of 2 tradition-rich programs. The decision to jump to the highest level of competition stirred an emotional debate. From KVNO in Omaha, Robin Wish reports.
You know, I got 1 year left, and I don't want to spend it here just in the books. I want to be out on the mat wrestling, representing all you guys.
It was an emotional night for UNO's Maverick wrestlers on March 13th. Isai Dominguez joined his teammates at a hastily called rally after they got the news their program would be cut. It was the same night the team brought home its 3rd straight national championship title.
And it's pretty hard for me, because UNO is my home, and I grew up here, so I can't want to see that go. So don't let them take apart my family, as you guys are.
The Maverick wrestlers became the face of UNO's swift move to Division I this spring. Protests, anger, and controversy swirled around the campus, and the cuts to wrestling, as well as UNO's 100-year-old football team, made Trev Alberts, UNO's athletic director, seem callous to some. But Albert said he didn't have a choice. Speaking later in March before University Board of Regents hearing to approve the move, he said without a dramatic shift, Maverick Athletics would be broke in a matter of years.
And I can tell you that there's nothing more uncomfortable for me than to stand here and tell you that athletics have become a business. Because I assure you, it's the last thing that I'd want to be a part of. I didn't take the job at UNO thinking we were running a business. We thought we were running an athletic department.
The Mavericks were bleeding money, Albert said, and continuing as Division II was not an option. Charged with bringing financial stability to the department when he took the job, Albert said he weighed the options and the choice became clear. Athletics could either take a step backwards and become the less expensive option of non-scholarship Division III, or take a giant step forward to D1. New NCAA rules say a school can only join D1 with a conference invitation, and then the invite came from the Summit League.
Then we started taking a hard look at the Summit League and what its championship offerings were and what sports they sponsored on the championship level within the conference structure, and recognized that both football and wrestling were not offered as part of the championship sports.
Soccer and golf were offered in the Summit League, so they recently became UNO's newest sports. Ultimately, the Regents gave the move and the cuts the green light. Regent Chuck Hassebrook said the cost of athletics had to be balanced with the school's academic mission.
Taxpayers are not willing to support unlimited expenditures, and so, you know, I think that the first thing we have to do is protect our academic programs, because first and foremost, we're here to be an educational institution, and that has to come first. And so I think this is a very constructive plan that enables us to keep strong athletic programs, but does so in a way that stops the hemorrhaging of money from athletics at UNO.
But whether competing in Division I will stop the bleeding remains to be seen. UNO paid a $1.4 million one-time application fee to the NCAA, the first school to do so by the new rules. They'll make most of that money back by cutting football and wrestling, but they paid out just under $1 million more in severance packages. And an NCAA study in 2008 reported only 17 of the more than 300 Division I athletic programs were profitable. UNO's success might depend on whether football-crazed Nebraskans can welcome soccer and golf to the fold.
Start the count. Go ahead.
One, two.
One, two.
The brand-new soccer team held open tryouts last week, which drew dozens of hopefuls, including some former football players. The team has been reaching out to the community to drum up support. They came out to a baseball game Wednesday night where coach Jason Mims kicked the first pitch.
We're excited. We're trying to create as much positive energy as we can create. You know, our guys have been doing some things on campus. We've been doing obviously some things off campus here in the community tonight. And we're just trying to get the word out that we are Division I and we do have a men's soccer team at UNO.
The team's off to a good start. On August 26th, they defeated last year's Summit League champions, UMKC, in their first game ever. For Only a Game, I'm Robin Wish in Omaha.
Apparently, the saga of the People v. Roger Clemens, who was charged with perjury after his testimony before Congress in 2008, will continue. In July, a mistrial was declared when U.S. District Court Judge Reggie Walton ruled that the prosecution had violated evidentiary guidelines the judge had established. Yesterday afternoon, Judge Walton scolded the prosecution but granted them a new trial, which is scheduled for April 17th. Defense attorneys had asked the judge to dismiss the 6-count indictment against Clemens. It's 19 minutes past the hour. James Straub did not intend to impersonate a clown last Sunday. He intended to dress like a golfer. It can be maintained that there's no distinction, I guess, but when the Genesee County Sheriff in Batavia, New York, got a report that a golf cart had been stolen by someone dressed like a clown, Mr. Straub was the fellow the sheriff tracked down. Perhaps it was the colorful golf clothing that gave the alleged miscreant away, or perhaps it was that he was driving the golf cart in question down the road near the Terry Hills Golf Course. In either case, Mr. Straub pleaded not guilty to driving while intoxicated. So far as the authorities in Genesee County have been able to determine, there is no law against dressing like a clown or a golfer. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game NFL Hall of Famer Harry Carson. But first, by baseball standards, the ultimate mark of consistency is Cal Ripken's record of 2,632 consecutive games played. By running standards, there are at least six men who consider Ripken's mark a short stretch. On Tuesday, Memphis, Tennessee resident John Simpson became the sixth person who has gone for a jog every day for at least 40 years, according to the U.S. Running Streak Association. Scott Cassiola's article, My Last Day Without a Jog, 1971, appeared this week in the Wall Street Journal, and he joins me now from the studios of NPR's New York Bureau. Scott, welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
Very well, thank you. And also joining me from his home in California is John Sutherland. He's one of those six runners. His last day without running occurred in May of 1969. John, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
Scott, in 2001, the U.S. Running Streak Association started tracking runners who go out for a daily jog. Tell us about the organization and its requirements.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, one of the great things about what John and these other gentlemen have done, who have done this for 40-plus years, is they started this without any sort of organization. They didn't set out to set these sort of records. They just kind of started running. Eventually, by the time this organization started, I mean, John had been running for 30 years. I imagine there are some runners now who have heard about this organization and become streak runners to become part of it. And I guess the requirement is pretty simple. You have to run at least 1 mile unaided every day. Most of these guys run well over 1 mile a day. I think Mark Covert said he'd only had three days over his 41 years when he's run 1 mile. Usually it's much, much more than that.
Well, the obvious question would seem to be, how can you confirm that somebody's been doing this? I mean, what if I walked into your office and said, I've been running for 45 years every day, 2 miles each time?
It is the honor system. I think there's nobody out there who can notarize what these guys are doing every day. I think you'd have to be kind of sick to make this stuff up. I don't know why you would. And I certainly believe everyone who says they have done this. I don't know why you would fabricate it. And I think these guys have a lot of mutual respect for each other. And I think there's sort of a code.
John, the association lists you as having its second longest streak. Mark Covert is the record holder. He's been running daily since July 1968. You and Covert have a long history together. Tell us how you know each other and how your streak started.
Well, that's true. I mean, I met Mark at LA Valley College, September of 1968. I was there as a baseball player, and he was one of the best high school runners in the area. And a friend of mine kidded me because I was running about 4 or 5 miles a day. You should go out for cross country. And I even hardly know what cross country was. So I went out and I enjoyed it. And I trained with him. I stared at his butt for 2 years. Okay. And then between my freshman and sophomore year, I moved to Las Vegas. And I remember one day Mark writing me and telling me that he'd run every day for a year. And I thought, hey, I'm going to try that. And then I remember when Mark is at Fullerton and he got to his anniversary for his fifth year, his teammates were going to tie him up and duct tape him so he couldn't run, and he drove out of town. And then it just took on a life of its own.
John, there have to have been days during this streak when you just woke up and said, nah, I don't think I'll do it today.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, the worst for me was I had that stomach flu where you just throw up everything you own overnight. So I ran to a park about a mile away, and I fainted. And my dog laid on my chest while these neighbors called the cops. There's somebody dead in the park. The cops woke me up. So what happened? I got to run another mile to get my streak going. And they offered to drive me home, and I ran back. It was downhill, so I made it. I ran back down the hill. But most of the time, it's not like that. You know, you feel pretty good when you wake up, and you just get out there and do it.
Scott, John Simpson is a retired dentist who lives in Memphis, Tennessee. And on Tuesday, he extended his streak to exactly 40 years. When he laced up his running shoes in 1971, do you suppose Dr. Simpson intended to keep at it this long?
You know, it's funny. I mean, he's got a really interesting story. He had polio as a teenager, and he decided to run to strengthen his legs. I mean, he still walks with a little bit of a limp. He doesn't limp when he runs. John is more of a recreational runner, but he still has that discipline to get up every morning. He gets up at dawn. He's out the door by about 5:30, runs around this little pumping station next to his home, and he does about 3 miles at a really leisurely pace, but it counts. I mean, he's running every single day, And it's just something he enjoys. His wife told me that he always has adhered to this sort of disciplined lifestyle, and running is one part of that. It shows you how sort of diverse the appeal of running can be.
People think we're all like machines and we get up and it's like a military thing. It's not. I mean, I was in the music business for 25 years. I was working at Metal Blade Records, and that label is famous for, they're the ones that discovered Metallica. And one day, the owner, Brian Slagle, along with the manager of Jane's Addiction and the manager of Dokken and Slayer, they said, "Hey, John, let's go out to dinner and have some fun." And I said, I can't, guys. I gotta go run 10 miles. And they looked at me, and you know, these guys have no idea that I even ran. And they go, "You'd rather run than eat?" And I go, "Look at this body. I'm 6'4" and weigh 158 pounds. And I said, "Does this body look like it's missed more meals or more workouts?" And they said, "More meals."
Scott, an untimed one-mile jog every day may not sound all that grueling to some of the runners in our audience, but tell us about what Ken Young pushed through to keep his streak alive.
Ken Young is a really interesting guy, and he has one of the more sort of gruesome tales of falling during one of his runs and breaking both of his wrists. And he went in for surgery the following morning. He said he had two steel plates in his wrists, and he went out that afternoon and jogged. He continued his streak.
That's impressive.
Yeah, that shows you. I mean, at a certain point, I think the streak becomes something that you're very conscious of. After maybe it's 20 years, 25 years, and you'll do almost anything to sort of preserve it. It would be an interesting experiment for you at home to sort of go out and try to do this for a week, 2 weeks, just see how it goes. Because 41 years is a hard number to conceptualize. I think it's 15,000 days. Yeah, it's 15,000 days of running every single day.
Scott Cassiola joined me from the studios of NPR's New York Bureau. His article, "My Last Day Without a Jog, 1971, appeared this week in the Wall Street Journal, and you can link to it at our website, onlyagame.org. Scott, thanks.
Great. Thanks, Bill.
And John Sutherland has run every day since May of 1969. John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It's been my pleasure. Take care, you guys.
Harry Carson was so exhausted by his first high school football practice in Florence, South Carolina, that he bailed out early and quit the team. Several decades later, in 2006, following a 13-year career with the New York Giants and a wait that lots of his contemporaries felt was longer than it should have been, Carson was inducted into the Football Hall of Fame. Now, Harry Carson has written a book titled "Captain for Life, My Story as a Hall of Fame Linebacker," and he joins me from NPR's New York Bureau. Mr. Carson, welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, thanks for having me here.
You earned all sorts of honors as a linebacker with the New York Giants, who drafted you in 1976. You got all rookie honors. You played on a Super Bowl winner in 1986. You were selected to play in 9 Pro Bowls. But I gather from the book that what you value most is what some of the guys you hit said about how hard you hit them. And one of those guys was O.J. Simpson. Tell us about the particular post-game encounter with him that stands out for you.
I was walking off the field after playing against the San Francisco 49ers. And O.J. Simpson was the running back of that team at the time. He had already had his heyday with the Buffalo Bills, and it was his last year. And I remember him coming up to me, and he tugged at my jersey. And he said, "Hey, Carson." And I said, "Hey, Juice, what's up?" He said, "Man, I've been hit by some of the best, but I've never been hit as hard as you hit me today." And when he said that, you know, I was floored, because here's a guy who at the time held the NFL rushing records. He had rushed for over 2,000 yards in one season. I took it as a great compliment.
In 1986, with Bill Parcells as head coach, the Giants won the Super Bowl. How important was that win in terms of your own self-esteem as a player?
It was a great win after those down years in the early or late 70s and early 80s. It was the fulfillment of a commitment that we all made toward one another. It was gratifying to me because for a guy like me and George Martin, who had been a part of the team during those lean years, we saw just how bad it was for the fans, for the players, for the Giant organization. And to win a Super Bowl, it was much sweeter for us as older players as opposed to some of the younger guys who were coming in. So it was gratifying from that standpoint.
You devote a large portion of Captain for Life to the damage inherent in the game, and you describe one play during a game against the Redskins in 1982 when you were hit in the head and found you couldn't understand what the defensive coach, Bill Belichick, was calling from the sideline. How did you hide your confusion from your teammates and coaches?
Well, you know, when you play, especially back then, you played a very physical game. We were playing the Washington Redskins, and we were playing down in RFK Stadium. Riggins is a running back who didn't try to run around you. They ran one play where we hit head-to-head. And so I got up, and I went back to the huddle. So I looked over to the sideline, and everything faded to black. And it was just a momentary thing where I just lost my vision. I squeezed the hands of the guys next to me, and, you know, my eyesight was restored. I realized I was in a football game. I'm the captain. I looked over to the sideline. Bill Belichick flashed in the signal for the next defense on the next play. I did not understand what the signal was, and so I tapped my helmet, and he flashed the signal again. And I still could not interpret what the defense was. At the time, I didn't realize that I had sustained a concussion. For me, I just got my bell rung. And so it's not about keeping anything from my teammates. It wasn't about keeping anything from the coaches or trainers. It was something that was just part of the game.
Tell us about how you learned after your career that your head injuries were going to have long-term consequences.
Well, I knew something was going on when I played, and I couldn't really put my finger on exactly what the issues were. Once I left football, it was a different story because I went into broadcasting, and I would go on the air, and there were times when I would lose my train of thought live, but there were some of these other issues tingling in my arms occasionally. Whenever, you know, I would sit for a period of time and I would stand up, I would lose my balance, or everything would fade to black, and I'd feel like, you know, I was about to faint. So I went to my doctor for my yearly physical. He referred me to a neurosports psychologist, and I went to this guy. I went through 2 days of testing, and he came back, and he said, "You have a mild post-concussion syndrome." And I said, "Okay, am I going to live?" And he said, "Yeah, you'll live." Then I just went on to, you know, begin to live my life in such a way that I knew that I was going to have issues, but I had to understand the issues that I was dealing with and how to manage those issues.
As you say in the book, for years, the National Football League denied the connection between head injuries players suffered and conditions like memory loss and migraines, depression, and other neurological problems. Do you think that over the past year or so, the league and the Players Association have become more responsible about addressing the problems and challenges faced by former players?
The league is beginning to understand what is going on with retired players. It was frustrating for many years because many of these players were dealing with issues and nobody really believed them. There were people who thought that these players were, you know, pulling their leg, or it was some way to get more disability or so forth. But the NFL, I think, is now more plugged into the issues of traumatic brain injury and neurological problems in the players. And I think they're taking these players at their word now more than ever.
You write that you would not want your own sons to play pro football, obviously because of the injury factor. And I can't help asking, if were someone to give you the opportunity to roll back the clock to the day after that first high school football practice, you would have chosen then to keep playing the game.
I knew at the age of 7 that you could get hurt playing football. And I went to my first college football game, and I saw players help another player off the field, and he was hobbling off the field. So I recognized very early on that you could get hurt playing, and I analyzed that risk, and I assumed that risk, and I think every player assumes that risk that he could get hurt, but, you know, you go ahead and you play. From a neurological standpoint, though, if someone had told me I could sustain some kind of damage that might be lifelong, I would have turned down the opportunity to play. Part of the reason why I wrote the book is I want people who either watch football, have kids who play, want to play football, players who are playing football, players who have played football, people who just go out and buy popcorn and a beer and they watch the Super Bowl. I want everybody to understand the neurological risk that these players are taking by playing the game. They can recover from a knee injury. They can always get the knee replaced. They can always get a hip replaced. No big deal. You'll still be able to move on and be functional. But once you injure the brain, that is a different story. For someone who has already played the game, they may be looking at potential memory loss. They may be looking at Alzheimer's. They may be looking at dementia and so forth. I just want people to be fully informed now.
Harry Carson, who played for 13 years with the New York Giants, is the author of Captain for Life, My Story as a Hall of Fame Linebacker. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. And Mr. Carson joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Harry, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
To hear more of my conversation with Harry Carson, please visit onlyagame.org and click on podcast. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world. extension.harvard.edu. And Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. This is NPR.
This year's edition of the World Gravy Wrestling Championships at the Rosen Bowl Pub, Stackstead's Rosendale, drew an impressive 1,500 spectators, a turnout host and landlord John Lowe termed superb. Winners of each bout were determined by a vote of the audience, some members of which wore flecks of gravy despite their attempts to keep the action at a distance. Contestants dressed as chickens, little Bo Peep, and various other creatures, real and imaginary, mucked about in the gravy ring to raise money for the East Lancashire Hospice. Elliot Rourke, who won last year's contest dressed as a bunny girl, failed to repeat, perhaps because of the texture of the medium. I would say the gravy was of a slightly finer consistency than it was last year, Rourke said. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, another one of those sports I've never been tempted to try, cliff diving. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Weenie.
I opened the door, you walked through.
No, I mean, that's one of the ones I like to refer to as Wide World of Sports.
There it is.
Remember Jim McKay?
I do.
He used to have target diving in Las Vegas
the
and cliff diving.
The agony of defeat.
And figure eight racing from Islip, New York.
According to published reports,
Sports!
Bill Burke, the man who founded the Los Angeles Marathon, has offered $1.2 billion to buy the Dodgers. The deal would be a record for a major league franchise and would have to be approved by MLB and the court overseeing the bankruptcy of the Dodgers. Do you think Mr. Burke realizes he's bidding for a bankrupt franchise?
Well, I think the bankruptcy is purely a legal device at this point. The Dodgers are still a pretty valuable property. I think maybe, first of all, a couple of questions have to be asked. The first thing, how does a guy who founded the Los Angeles Marathon have $1.2 billion to bid for the Los Angeles Dodgers, you say? Ha! I have an answer. There are foreign investors, and according to the story on the bid, specifics weren't given on the foreign investors except to characterize them as, quote, certain state-owned investment institutions of the People's Republic of China. First of all, are there any investment institutions in the People's Republic of China that aren't state-owned?
I'm not sure how thoroughly we want to investigate.
We might want to vet this one pretty carefully.
Good news. Ace Steven Strasburg is ready to return to the Washington Nationals after Tommy John surgery. And really, the Nats have plenty of time to turn their season around.
He should not be returned to the major leagues this soon after Tommy John surgery for a team that is little more than a AAA team itself.
The NFL preseason is officially complete. We were warned, Charlie, that after a summer without contact between coaches and players and the end of two-a-day practices, teams would not be prepared for the preseason, let alone the regular season. Are those warnings turning out to be correct?
No, the preseason turned out to be just about as essentially worthless as an act of consumer fraud as it would be whether or not they had a lockout. Peyton Manning is probably not going to start at the beginning of the season. That wouldn't have changed. The lockout has no effect on whether or not he plays. I mean, the Lions look extraordinarily good right now, but that doesn't mean anything because a few years ago they looked extraordinarily good in the exhibition season and won two games. So I think in the long view, in a couple of years when they look down the line, they're going to discover that not very much was lost by the lockout.
The sanctions against various Miami football players who benefited from the generosity of convicted felon Nevin Shapiro have begun. Do the punishments, which mostly seem to consist of short suspensions and giving the money back, fit the crimes?
Well, I think for the moment they do. I think that the real 9,000-pound dung bomb is going to get dropped in this program down the line. But I think for the moment the University of Miami could have been tougher, but I think everybody in the world knows what's coming, and I'm not going to be too outraged that the original sanctions aren't tough.
On Wednesday, Wade Bellick, late of the NHL's Nashville Predators, was found dead in Toronto, apparently a suicide. He was 35. Along with Rick Rippian and Derek Bogard, Bellick is the third player or former player who could be characterized as an enforcer to have died since May. The league says they will investigate whether these deaths are in any way related, but do you expect anything to come out of that sort of investigation?
I certainly hope so, because this is now officially a trend. I think that when you get slotted into being a goon or an enforcer, I think that you are, to an extent, dehumanized. And so are the people you're supposed to be enforcing whatever it is you're enforcing against. I think you're encouraged to think of your fellow players as less than human. I think you're encouraged to think of yourself as less human than a weapon. I think this is a psychology that once you leave the game, there's no place for it in the civilized world. And I think, yes, this is something hockey ought to look at very seriously.
Last week's reprise of Stories Past, having provided each of us with time off, you and I have not spoken since Pat Summitt, the extraordinarily accomplished coach of the women's basketball team at Tennessee, revealed that she has early onset Alzheimer's disease. How do you feel about her decision to continue coaching?
I love it. The one thing, and as you know, I have a particularly nasty dog in this fight. My father succumbed to it, as did all four of his siblings. One of the biggest changes in public awareness in Alzheimer's is the fact that people who are diagnosed are now coming forward and describing their experiences while they're still capable of doing so. If Pat Summitt wants to go out there and say, look, I have early onset Alzheimer's, I'm on a therapy, I can still coach my basketball team, God bless her. There is no team I am rooting for in the world more than I am rooting for the Tennessee Volunteers this year.
Lots of athletes and former athletes have attempted to increase their celebrity value by dancing with the stars on TV, Charlie. Next season's roster of athletes turned hoofers was revealed this week. How do you like the lineup?
I will bet you all the money in my pocket right now, which is about 85 cents, that Hope Solo is in the finals of Dancing with the Stars next year. I would guarantee. I think that's the easiest bet on the board anywhere. As for Ron Artest, be generous with your marks because, you know, monitor screens have been known to fly.
Doesn't take criticism well.
And finally, Charlie, and don't say sports because this is a sports story.
There's no question.
Have you something to say about the $400 billion plan to build a mountain in the Netherlands?
Well, at least if the dikes fail, they'll all have someplace to go
get
now.
Get to the high ground.
Go to the high ground. We have it now. Yes, apparently... Dutch skiers and snowboarders, of which there are at least 12 apparently, have been complaining because they don't have any mountains. So a design company has designed up plans, and the Dutch are going to build a mountain. It is going to take $400 billion and 30 years. Can they at least find a molehill?
This is the Dutch version of Sagrada Familia in Barcelona, which is they'll be building long
after. There are 13 people in America who just got that joke. It's wonderful.
Public radio. Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America, among other books. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
That's a lot of tulips for $400 billion.
First there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is. First there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is. First there is a mountain, then there is no mountain, then there is. First there is a mountain.
Tomorrow, 13 men will fling themselves off Aurora Cliff, overlooking the Cape of Itador during the last stop of the 2011 Red Bull Cliff Diving Series. Where's that, you ask? Well, it's near Yalta on the Crimean shore in southern Ukraine. But a couple of weeks ago, the series was much closer to home. From Boston, Only a Game's Karen Given has our story.
Nikki Stajkovic, the sports director for the Red Bull Cliff Diving Series, is out to prove the theory that cliff divers collect more stamps on their passports than anyone else.
Definitely. I think I've already gone around the world at least 8 times this year.
This year?
Yeah, this year alone.
In Greece, 15,000 to 20,000 people showed up to watch cliff divers leap into the sunken lake at Vouliagmeni. 40,000 spectators were on hand for the tour stop in Italy and 70,000 in France. In Boston, Stajkovic expects a capacity crowd, about 20,000 or whatever the crowded harbor can hold. On a windy Wednesday afternoon, Stajkovic is supervising the installation of a diving platform atop the tour's only urban stop, the Institute of Contemporary Art. Not a cliff, but a large glass building with a cantilevered roof perched on the edge of the water. When the museum opened in late 2006, the Boston Globe opined, quote, "With the possible exception of a lighthouse, there's probably never been a building more intensely involved with the sea." This event will test the ICA's connection to the sea. That is, Stajkovic says, if workers can ever get the platform stable enough without touching one of Boston's newest architectural landmarks.
And that's what they're working on right now, is trying to get that platform to be a platform and not a springboard. If it's a springboard, it's much more dangerous and not really doable.
Danger seems to be the only thing cliff divers face more often than customs agents. Stajkovic says at 88 feet, nearly 3 times the height of Olympic platform diving, belly flops are not an option.
Even if you land perfectly straight, it's still a huge impact. The big key is being able to control 4 somersaults and 1.5 twists, and then be able to land perfectly straight up and down. Because no matter how good in shape you are, if you land flat, It's just, you know, it's really going to hurt, put you in the hospital.
It's fitting, then, that the most well-known judge for this weekend's event is a diver known for landing flat, really, really flat. At the 1988 Seoul Olympics, American Greg Louganis famously smacked his head on the 3-meter springboard, but went on to become the first man to retain Olympic gold in both the springboard and platform events. Louganis says the outcome would not be nearly as good if that sort of accident happened from this platform, nearly 27 meters above the harbor.
I mean, on 10-meter platform, they calculated, I don't know how they did it, but, you know, they say that we're hitting the water at like 35 miles per hour. Off here, they said that their calculations are like more like 65 miles per hour. So, I mean, it's twice the speed practically, and, you know, it's quite an impact. You can get hurt. You can get hurt.
You say that with a big smile on your face.
Better them than me.
Louganis has never dived from this height, but this isn't his first exposure to the sport. He worked as a color commentator for ESPN during the Acapulco Cliff Diving World Championship in the late 80s.
At that time, I mean, it didn't have the credibility and respect. It was, you know, the daredevilish, you know, off these cliffs and jump out far enough to miss the rocks and, the tide coming in and all that. Now there's a lot of safety precautions that they take with the cliff diving events that Red Bull is doing.
Louganis says Red Bull also published rules and judging criteria, two things the sport had been lacking, and standardized the height of the platforms to between 26.5 and 28 meters so that the athletes can better plan their dives. An hour before the start of the competition, Stephen LeBoux stops by to say hello to the Boo Crew, a group of friends from his hometown in New Jersey. They're all wearing black T-shirts with Living the Dream in big yellow letters across the back. Mike Lovett says the shirts are accurate.
You know, most people would say they're nuts, but that's Steve. Steve is the person who, if it snowed real hard in the winter, he would say, hey, let's pile up some snow, jump off our roof into the pile of snow, and let's do a flip while we're doing it. We might break a leg, but cool. So him diving off 90 feet is, it's amazing, but it doesn't surprise me that he does it because he's an adrenaline junkie.
In just a bit, LeBoux will be performing a dive he's only tried twice before, once in practice and once in yesterday's preliminary competition. These divers' bodies can't take many repetitions. Besides, LeBoux says, where would they do them?
You know, there's no 27-meter platforms out there. So we're forced to practice on 10-meter, and sometimes 17, 22 is about as high as it goes, really. We'll do maybe one repetition, and then you're ready to go. Whereas, you know, I couldn't throw one pitch and say I'm ready to pitch in the majors. And so it's a unique challenge.
You know how high 88 feet is? Well, come here. Let's take a look. First off, it's over.
The announcers ask the crowd for silence as the first diver gets ready to jump. But it's really not necessary. It's hard to breathe, peering up into the sky and watching his towel slowly flutter to the water. It's even more terrifying to watch him tumble and twist for nearly 3 seconds before seamlessly disappearing under the water.
Now let's wait till he comes to the surface to make sure he's all right. And there he is!
Mike Lovett has watched his friend Steve LeBoux dive from this height only a few times, but he's not worried.
I hold my breath when he hits the water because, you know, he's told me stories about if you hit the water too shallow or too far, what happens to you when you fall in the water. And it's not all pleasant, but when he hits in, he gets in the water and he rips that entry, you can't do anything but cheer.
LeBoux does not disappoint with his first dive, earning nines from the judges and huge cheers from the Boo Crew. The dive puts him in first place for a while, but it's hard to compete against some of the more experienced divers, including defending champion Gary Hunt. When most of the divers enter the water, the announcers remind the crowd to hold their cheers until they've resurfaced and given a thumbs up. But even when Gary Hunt is performing a back triple somersault with a quad twist, the most difficult dive in the competition, those sorts of precautions don't seem to be necessary.
We can all celebrate with that one! The triple quad down beautifully, Gary Hunt!
Steve LeBoux botches his final dive and ends up in fifth place overall. Fellow American Kent DeMond's efforts are good enough for third. But the big news of the day comes as Gary Hunt takes the platform for his final attempt. By virtue of simply making the finals in Boston, Hunt has defended his title as Red Bull cliff diving champion. Hunt doesn't even need to finish the event, but it's not like he's going to turn away from the platform and go home.
Make some noise for UK's own Gary Hunt!
After the trophies are handed out and the top three finishers spray each other with champagne, I find Steve LeBoux on the judges' dock, holding an ice pack to the swollen lip and chipped tooth he received on that last dive.
High diving skills or hospital bills?
Gary Hunt is surrounded by reporters asking him what it feels like to clinch the series 2 weeks before the final competition. He says the event will still be fun and exciting. After all, from these heights, he's always risking injury and even death. And just because he's got the series all wrapped up, don't expect him to be taking it easy.
I could just have a holiday and relax, but I love this sport, so I'll be there. And it always takes a while to relax our bodies because even doing perfect dives, your body feels the strain. So I'm going to have a week off and relax and then get back into training.
Gary Hunt says he might even try out a new dive at tomorrow's event in Yalta. Regardless, he will collect $20,000 for winning the 2011 Cliff Diving World Series to add to the prize money he earned along the way. But like the rest of these athletes, Gary Hunt has a day job. After this weekend, the two-time world champion will go back to diving for tourists at a French amusement park called Wally Gator. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Gibbon.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Welcome this week to our new intern, Jillian Guybe. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Karen's museum diving photo gallery or learn more about this week's music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word this week comes from Red Bull Cliff Diving World Series director Nikki Stajkiewicz, who dismisses concerns that Boston Harbor water is too dirty for the divers.
You know, we've been like in Hamburg where they have the big shipping industry, and that water looked pretty ugly. And I just took showers afterwards.
Yeah, well, I'll take the showers too, but I'm not diving off anything 88 feet high. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.